The Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas. All persons having business before the Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas, are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the state of Texas and this honorable court.
Thank you. Please be seated.
Good morning. The court has three matters on its oral submission docket. In the order of their appearance, they are docket number 050108, Daughters of Charity Health Services of Waco versus Donald Lindstater and Kenneth Boland from McLennan County in the 10th Court of Appeals District. Docket number 050326, N. Ray D. Wilson Construction Company, an original proceeding which has been consolidated with docket number 050327, American Standard and Train Company et al. Versus Brownsville Independent School District from Cameron County in the 13th Court of Appeals District, and docket number 050832, Lamar Homes, Inc. versus Mid-Continent Casualty Company, which is here on certified questions from the United States Court of Appeals for the Fifth Circuit. The court has allotted 20 minutes per side in each of these arguments, and the court will take a brief recess between the arguments, and we expect to conclude all of them before noon. These proceedings are being recorded, and a link to the arguments should be posted on the court's website by the end of the day today. The court is now ready to hear argument in 050108, Daughters of Charity Health Services of Waco versus Donald Lindstater and Kenneth Boland.
May it please the court, Mr. Anthony Swain will present argument for the petitioner. Petitioner has reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the court, opposing counsel. My name is Andrew Swain. I represent Providence Hospital in Waco, Texas. A little over 10 years ago, the respondents in this case, Mr. Lindstater and Mr. Boland, presented themselves to the Providence Hospital emergency room with severe injuries following a head-on collision. They were treated. They ultimately were released. It turns out that they were on the job when that collision took place. The workers' comp carrier paid Providence Hospital a little less than half of its total billed charges for their admission to the emergency room and hospital care, and Providence Hospital filed a hospital lien with respect to any potential claims against third parties that may have arisen out of that accident. After that, the respondents then became plaintiffs, and they sued third-party tortfeasor John Paul Jones. Later, I believe they proceeded against the estate of John Paul Jones. As a part of that lawsuit, they made claims for the total billed charges from Providence Hospital. And the numbers are not large. There's something on the, for both of them, there's something on the order of $22,000. As of that point in time, the workers' comp carrier had paid something less than $10,000 to Providence Hospital. Ultimately.
And whatever the numbers are, there's no dispute.
Whatever the numbers are, there's no dispute. There's an agreed statement of facts. The numbers are set out accurately in the Court of Appeals opinion. Ultimately, the respondents here, the plaintiffs there, Lindstater and Boland, settled their case against the third-party tortfeasor for $175,000. Providence was paid the $12,000 or so dollars that was left remaining on its hospital liens. It released its hospital liens against the causes of action against the third-party tortfeasor. Thereafter, Lindstater and Boland became plaintiffs again, and they sued Providence Hospital in McLennan County for a declaration that its hospital lien was not any good because of the Workers' Comp Act. And obtained that declaration from the trial court and again from the Court of Appeals. The amounts of money here are not large. What is it really at issue in my mind is this is a case where we ought to look to a fair and just result. And it is not a fair and just result for these two gentlemen to be able to sue the third-party tortfeasor.
Well, let me ask you about that.
Yes, ma'am.
You claim they have a windfall.
Yes, ma'am.
But I don't see how that can be under the structure of the code, because they're either going to give it up through the comp reimbursement to the comp carrier. in future medical or future benefits, or they're going to give it up if we decide that the hospital's entitled to the excess. Well, so it's hard for me to see how the plaintiffs can get a windfall.
In many, many cases, first of all, in many, many cases, there are no future benefits. If the future benefits are large material, and frankly, we've not cited the cases in our brief, but the comp carriers intervene in those cases and get a determination. There's a case called Texas Workers' Compensation Insurance Fund versus Travis. It's a Fort Worth Court of Appeals case, 912 Southwest 2nd, 895, that I pulled yesterday, that talks about how the carriers intervene and get a determination of what their future benefit and credit is going to be as a result of the recovery in any case. There is a windfall, though, where the plaintiffs make a claim for medical, which they have not paid for, but which arguably they have incurred, either try or settle their case and get a recovery based on that medical. And then they turn around and tell the hospital that was required to take them in for treatment to begin with, you don't get your part of that.
But ultimately it's going to come out of the comp carrier's pocket. They're the ones who are going to pay.
Not for the additional.
If they don't get the credit against future benefit.
Yes, ma'am.
I mean, presume with me that there are future benefits here,
okay.
Future medical.
Okay.
Because we don't know that. But presume there is, then the hospital gets its amount at the expense of the comp carrier because they'll be denied the future credit.
That may or may not be. How could that not be?
Presuming future medical.
Number one, it depends on how the numbers work out. Number two, it depends on whether or not the comp carrier actually intervenes in the case, which it should. If it's material at all, the comp carrier ought to intervene in the case to determine what the numbers are and get a judicial determination of what credit it's going to receive out of the proceeds of the case as against its future benefits payable.
But do you think recovery, right to recover, the hospital's right to recover, should turn on whether there's windfall to the injured workers?
What I believe, Judge, is that these two statutes, the compact and the provision of the compact and the Hospital Lien Act, ought to be read together. There is a way to read these statutes together where all of those interests are accommodated.
Do you think it matters that they presented at the emergency room as opposed to a compensation physician?
Yes, I do believe that it makes a difference that they presented at the emergency room. The Hospital Lien Act applies primarily to emergent-type situations where the admission is made within 72 hours of the accident that actually caused the injury to begin with. For the most part, those are emergent-type situations.
So you think if under those circumstances and where the recovery was going to be eaten up in future medical, the hospital wouldn't get anything additional, but if that were not the case, the hospital might?
There is a way to read the statutes together where that works. If you look at 417.002 of the Labor Code and 417.001 of the Labor Code, you can make an argument and you could reasonably read these statutes together that if the comp carrier intervenes and establishes whatever its future, you know, whatever its future benefit credit is going to be, which is what it ought to do if it's going to be substantial, then the hospital takes after that. You could read the statutes in order to do that. I do not believe that the comp carrier ought to have an ethereal, free-floating obligation out there that is not solidified and delineated someplace in some judicial writing, a judgment or an order of some type, because frankly, that doesn't serve the benefits of the comp claimant. They don't necessarily know what their credit is going to be. It doesn't serve the benefits of the comp carrier because they haven't established what that is. And it certainly does not mesh with the Hospital Lien Act and the protections that are given by the Hospital Lien Act for the hospital's full bill charges.
Mr. McSwain,
yes,
everything
sir?
We know about the settlement with the Jones, the third-party tortfeasor, is in the agreed statement of facts. Is that right?
I believe that that's correct, yes, sir.
So is there anything in those fact statements that tell us what damages besides medical expenses were alleged by the workers in this case.
To tell you the truth, I am not sure whether or not there is. I believe that it is a fair assumption that there was also mental anguish and pain and suffering.
So do we know whether the hospital's liens were a significant part of that settlement or not? How do we understand what the breakdown is?
Well, the way the numbers work, the hospital's lien interests that were unpaid by the comp carrier were something on the order of $12,000, which is less than 10% of the overall settlement. Somewhat more if you take out the attorney's fees and make it a net settlement. But the hospital liens were not significant portions of these settlement proceeds.
If we were to find your way, wouldn't that be a disincentive for the hospital to seek payment under the Comp Act? I mean, the Comp Act contemplates a procedure by which the hospital can go in and if it doesn't think it gets paid enough, seek more payment.
Yes, ma'am. There is, and the amicus has pointed out that there is a right of appeal. And as we pointed out in our response, some of the hospital reimbursement rates have not been increased since 1997.
But regardless, it allows an end run around that procedure.
And the except in the instance where the excess recovery is completely eaten up with future benefits claims. Those funds, the difference between the comp payment and what the actual charges are, would come out of third-party monies, either third-party insurance monies or third-party assets somehow. It doesn't come out of the comp system. It doesn't come out of the pocket of the claimant.
But don't we have an exhaustion problem here? I mean, shouldn't they have to go through that procedure first and determine the most that they can be compensated by comp before you even reach the question?
Judge, I honestly do not believe that to be the case. I don't believe that the legislature impliedly canceled out the protections of the Hospital Lien Act by the enactment in 1989 and the subsequent codification in 1993 of the Workers' Comp Act. The Comp Act does not say that the debt is extinguished. What the Comp Act says in 432.042 is that the hospital may not pursue the injured employee. It does not say that the hospital cannot pursue its Hospital Lien Act rights against third-party tortfeasors.
Mr. McSwain?
Yes, sir.
I don't recall. Is there a provision in the Comp Act apart from the hospital lien statute that protects medical providers in regard to third-party actions, that the comp carrier and medical providers might be protected on those?
I'm not sure that I understand exactly what you're asking, but 417.001 and 417.002 basically say that the comp carrier is subrogated to the rights of the injured employee standing in his shoes with respect to the recovery of at least the past medical expenses, and in my view, under this Travis case, ought to be as to the future medical expenses and benefits that may be payable. That's all that I know about that would.
Is there a process by which the carrier, in the Act, is there a process by which the carrier claims that other than intervening? Can they go to the commission? Can they say, look, they can bring the settlement over?
I honestly don't know the technical answer to that question. As a practical matter, in any personal injury suit where the workers' comp carrier is involved, they have to be taken care of. Everybody knows that in the context of those cases.
First, they have to be taken care of first.
That's my belief, Judge. I think they have to be taken care of first.
And then would the hospital come next?
I believe the hospital would come next.
And you wouldn't participate pro rata, in your view, with the claimant. It would be the comp carrier first, the hospital next, and then whatever's left.
I believe that's right. The Hospital Lien Act requires that the charges be reasonable and necessary. And as a matter of fact, in this case, the plaintiffs, if they go to court to prove their medical damages and they claim the total bill charges, they have to prove that they're reasonable and necessary. So how can they claim these charges are reasonable and necessary, recover damages for them? Let's say that they try the case and they recover damages, and the damages that they recover for past medical are twice what the comp carrier is paid, just like in this case. Can the plaintiffs then turn around and say the hospital shouldn't be paid for its reasonable and necessary expenses that we have proven up in court beyond what the comp carrier pays, particularly in a situation involving emergent care like this one, where EMTALA, the federal act, requires the hospital to take that patient in and treat them with no chance of discharge or any other resolution until that patient's status has been stabilized.
But we would have to find, wouldn't we, that the comp rates are not fair and reasonable.
No, ma'am, I don't believe that you have to find that at all.
Why not?
The comp rates are set out, and I'm not agreeing that they are, but the comp rates are set out by statute through the legislative authority and then the rulemaking process from the then Workers' Comp Commission, now the Texas Department of Insurance. The Hospital Lien Act, Lien, we believe, basically is in addition to the workers' comp rates when that recovery comes from a third party's hands. If you look at Bashara, the case that the Texas Supreme Court case that deals with the Hospital Lien Act, it says that one of the justifications for the Hospital Lien Act is to make sure that the hospital recovers its costs. May I finish my briefly, Andy?
Finish briefly.
Okay. Well, now I forgot what I was going to say. We believe that Bashara says that the hospital is entitled to recover its cost, and that one of the, if you look at Bashara, it says that one of the purposes is for the of the Hospital Lien Act is in pursuit of that purpose to be paid fully in its charges. I don't believe that you do have to find that the comp rates are unreasonable in order to read the two statutes together. Thank you.
Thank you. The court is now ready to hear argument from the respondent.
May it please the court. Mr. Derek Gilliland will present argument for the respondent.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the court and honorable opposing counsel. I believe, Your Honor, that the one thing I would like to clear up in the brief summary of the facts that Mr. McSwain gave the court is simply the timing of the liens, because in a way I think it I think it's just helpful to know that the plaintiffs, Mr. Lindstetter and Boland, were treated in the emergency room in the beginning of January 1996. The hospital filed liens within a few days of that treatment. Sometime later, the hospital received payment. The exact date is not in the agreed statement of facts or in the record, but sometimes later received payment for the from the workers' comp carrier for those services. The liens stayed as they were, and those liens, as stated in the record, show that the amount due and owing is the full amount. They were never adjusted. There's no evidence that they were ever adjusted to account for the fact that at least some payment had been made. And then when the settlement was made, the liens were paid back out of the settlement. Now, I'm here on behalf of Mr. Lindstetter and Boland to ask this court to affirm the Court of Appeals and affirm the trial court for three primary reasons. And the first, as we've argued in our brief and as Texas Mutual has argued in their amicus filing, there was no debt because of the workers' comp statute on which this lien could be based, and Texas law requires a lien to have an underlying debt.
Mr. McSwain made some compelling arguments about a possible windfall in a situation where they claim amounts to be reasonable in court, yet try to compromise the lien for a lesser amount.
Well, and I have two issues with the windfall arguments. First of all, there's nothing in the record to address or to show that there is any windfall at all. To determine the plaintiffs received any sort of windfall requires the court to assume that the...
Well, they got more money than the hospital did.
They got more money than the hospital
by a long shot.
That's true that they got more than the hospital did, but there's nothing in the record to show the subrogation that had to be paid.
I'm just wondering, you know, our health policy here at the court's not that great. So if I go to the hospital and the hospital and our great health company decides Blue Cross, they're going to pay 50% of my hospital bills, and Brister's going to pay the rest. Now, if Brister recovers from whoever injured me, Brister doesn't get to keep the extra 50%. And Brister doesn't get to say, oh, no, well, all I was billed was what my insurer agreed to pay. No, that's just all my insurer agreed to pay. Don't I still have to pay the hospital the rest of my bill? That, and why is that different from workers' comp?
That depends on for two things. First of all, if you were injured on the job, you'd have the workers' comp coverage. You'd have full coverage, and you'd be in this situation.
It's hard to get injured on this job, but anyway.
Except during
some of the steps look tricky. But if your Blue Cross Blue Shield contract says that the hospital is agreeing to accept that as payment in full,
I agree. But we got nothing here that says the hospital, Providence Hospital, never agreed to charge this. I mean, this case wouldn't get here if Providence, if we had anything in writing where Providence Hospital agreed to lower rates.
Well, Your Honor, as far as the agreement goes, first of all, the Texas Administrative Code Section 4 or 28. Book of the Texas Administrative Code, Chapter of Rule 4210, says that by treating a patient or submitting a bill, you agree to be bound by the workers' comp provisions. Additionally, the Emergency Medical Treatment and Active Labor Act, 42 U.S.C. 1395
only
requires treatment to the point of stabilization. So if a hospital does not want to participate,
the workers
stabilize
comp,
a patient and transfer them.
Let me get a word in there.
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Workers' Comp Commission doesn't have authority to set hospital rates for hospitals in Texas, period. They have authority to set reimbursement rates, right?
That is correct.
So they can't say what hospitals can and can't charge. They can say only what hospitals can be reimbursed.
But the statute,
and in a free economy, anything else the hospital can get by with is a free economy. If you don't want it, you shouldn't go to the hospital, right?
Well, and I agree, Your Honor, that if you don't want medical care and you don't want to pay for it, don't go to the hospital. In this case, Mr. Bullen and Linstetter would have much preferred to never have to go to the hospital. But when they did, they were covered by the workers' comp system, and their bills were all to be paid by the workers' comp system, thus eliminating the debt, providing the subrogation right that the workers' comp carrier has, and protecting them for all of their medical expenses, because under the workers' comp statute, section 413.021 requires that the employee's entire medical care, regardless of when it happens, if it's related to this injury, is to be paid for by the workers' comp carrier, and that obligation by the carrier cannot be settled, cannot be eliminated. They are on the hook essentially until the patient passes away for all of the medical care related.
The claimants could have had a substantial windfall. I mean, it's possible for the numbers to work out so that it would be very substantial, and the loss or the impairment claim of the hospital that went unpaid would be very substantial as well.
I agree that it could.
How do you think that makes sense, statutory scheme?
Well, I think, first of all, that there are occasions under the law and under the nature of jury trials that somebody is going to wind up with a windfall. That will happen from time to time. I don't think that the record in this case is sufficient to support a conclusion that there was a windfall because there are too many things missing from the court's record. But in that situation, I think under the workers' comp statute and the fact that it's an all-encompassing system gives the hospital its avenue to challenge what it's been paid and what it's been billed. I think that allows the hospital an avenue to be made whole, to be made taken care of, or be taken care of, especially in light of the fact that the workers' comp statute under section, I believe it's 413.011, requires that the reimbursement rates be fair and reasonable and gives the hospital an avenue to challenge those. And then in addition, the workers' comp carrier is on the hook for all of these future medical benefits, and so we don't know if what today at trial might appear to be a windfall, but in 20 years when the back injury, the knee injury flares back up, requires additional surgeries, additional treatments, and the workers' comp carrier possibly comes back on the hook, that might not be a windfall after all. That's one of the supposed idiosyncrasies of our jury system, is you just never know exactly what the future might hold, but that decision has to be made before it's arrived. In that case, I think that the worker ought to get the benefit of that windfall as the workers' comp statute is set up to protect employees and employers. But I do not agree that in this situation there's any evidence in the court's record to justify the conclusion of their windfall. There's one single medical bill and then the statement that the entire past and future medical expenses were claimed in the case. Additionally, I think that Section 417.001 of the Labor Code is instructive in deciding whether or not the hospital should get any credit out of a net recovery by an employee. Section 417.02 deals with a situation where the employee sues the third party and discusses how the employee has to reimburse the workers' comp carrier. 417.001 entitles the workers' comp carrier to bring a claim on the employee's behalf should the employee decide not to do so. And 417 says that if the carrier does do so, files that workers' comp claim, it specifically tells us how any recovery is to be handled and says that first the carrier must reimburse itself, which is its subrogation interest, pay the cost from the amount recovered, and then, quoting subsection B2, pay the remainder of the amount recovered to the injured employee. There is no exception or provision made for payment of a hospital's additional charges.
Of course, they don't have any incentive. They're out of pocket $10,000 for the, they're not going to file a claim for medical expenses for $20,000 because they don't care about, they don't care, they could care less about the hospital.
Oh, the workers' comp carrier?
Yeah.
But what I'm saying, Your Honor, though, is the statute recognizes that the hospital.
I know, but they're not, you know, I mean, I'm troubled by, suppose this case has gone to trial. We have granulated issues. Everybody's afraid of Harrison County versus Smith, et cetera. So we have granulated issues. We have a specific finding by the jury of $20,000, which is the amount of the hospital bill, but it's not the amount of the workers' comp payment, which was only $10,000. So we know for a fact the judgment's paid, becomes final. We know for a fact we're handing over $20,000. $10,000 of it is workers' comp. $10,000 is the spread that goes to the hospital. Now, why does the plaintiff get to keep that?
The plaintiff gets to keep that because that spread is taken into account in the workers' comp system by way of a credit against future benefits that may at some point need to be paid. So,
and if they have no future benefits, if it's a broken leg and they're all better, they just get a motorboat as well as their bills paid.
I have to concede, Your Honor, in that situation, if they never have any future medical related to it, they don't develop arthritis, don't need knee replacements, don't need some other medical at some point in the future, then they did get the benefit of it. They did. I wouldn't go so far as to say $10,000 is a windfall because considering the circumstances.
We're assuming that the jury gave them everything they're entitled to for emotional anguish and everything else. They're just getting an extra motorboat.
So in that case, I think there might be a windfall, but I don't think it's unjust. And I think that windfall, when you take into account the provisions in the labor code that set up the workers' comp system, that the legislature has determined that we're going to protect the employee, and occasionally the employee might get a little extra benefit out of that, but more often than not.
Do you know how does it work? The employee comes up a year later, so, and he is now suffering injury that is related to this injury, and he's going to need some additional care and treatment and whatever. He makes a claim, I guess, for compensation benefits, and then does the carrier say, well, no, you have to exhaust that settlement that you got last year? How does that work?
The way that works, first of all, if I may, just before answering the court's question, Mr. McSwain said that when there is a future credit that the comp carrier should go to the court and get a determination. There's nothing in the comp code, in the labor code, or in the regulations that require a judicial finding to affect that future credit. And in my experience, the comp carrier wants to know what the net settlement is to the plaintiff, and they take that and put that into their file and into their information for the future credit. Now, the future credit, the way it is handled, is spelled out in Title 28, Section 42.75 of the Texas Administrative Code. And in that case, it says specifically when an injured worker has received an excess recovery, so you've gotten more than the subrogation amount after attorney's fees, so there's a future credit, then the carrier notifies the providers of the date of the judgment or agreed judgment and the amount of the excess. Then you file a copy of the judgment or agreed judgment, which would happen in a settlement situation, with the board. The provider is required to continue submitting reports as required by the comp statute, and bills and services provided after the judgment date are sent to the injured worker, and the injured worker pays those. Copies of the bills are also sent to the carrier, and when the carrier looks at the bills and says, okay,
so
the bills have met.
From that point on, the provider knows that it's up to the claimant to pay.
Correct.
And does the claimant pay the comp rates or the hospital's charges?
That is something I do not know the answer to, Your Honor.
What if the settlement said the medical has been covered by comp, no part of this payment is for any medical expenses, it's all for pain and suffering? I mean, does it allow, would a third-party settlement be able to allocate what it goes to?
I think that there is a situation where a third-party settlement could try and allocate that, and I'm not entirely sure what you're asking, but if there is a valid hospital lien, because a lien presupposes an underlying debt, I believe it was in the Herman Hospital versus Martinez case, the Houston Court of Appeals, they said that it doesn't matter what the jury finding is for medical expenses. If there's a valid lien, then any recovery is subject to that lien, even if it's all for pain and suffering. So I think if you have...
What case is that?
That's the Herman Hospital versus Martinez case. I believe it's actually cited in petitioner's brief.
You make the argument in your brief that the health care providers like the hospital aren't required to participate in the comp system. And that seems a fairly significant point of difference between you two, because that forms the basis of your argument that they don't have to. If they choose to, then they've sort of agreed that these are the rates that are going to be compensated, similar to in the private context, an insurance carrier agreeing that they'll accept the rates set out in the insurance agreement. They disagree with that premise.
They do, and I think our disagreement stems from 42 U.S.C. Section 1395 DD, which is the Emergency Medical Treatment and Active Labor Act. That requires a patient who presents to an emergency room to be treated by the hospital. Now, we agree with them to that extent, but that statute only requires treatment to the point of stabilization, meaning that if they get an employee, they get somebody in that's a workers' comp or somebody who they don't want to treat for one reason or another, they have to treat them to the point of stabilization, but then they can be transferred to a hospital that will participate in the comp system. There's been no evidence in this case that the actually either way to what extent the treatment went beyond stabilization. Up to the point of stabilization, I would agree that it is involuntary, but they haven't presented any evidence that this all included simply stabilizing the patient and were remanded to obtain more evidence that would be known, because this did exceed what was required for stabilization. Once they're stabilized, though, even under the Emergency Medical Treatment and Active Labor Act, the patient can be transferred, and quite frankly, in our area of the state, we see a lot of that with the rural hospitals that can't afford to participate in some of the different plans. We'll treat people and transfer them to Scott and White, or treat people and transfer them to another surrounding hospital. So beyond the point of stabilization, it's my contention that it was by agreement. Additionally, that section of Title 28 of the Texas Administrative Code 42.10 says that by billing or treating a covered worker, they have agreed to abide by and be governed by the provisions of the Workers' Compensation Act. On top of that, I think this is that the difference between the other cases, the Doar case out of, I think it was Illinois, I've forgotten, and then the Parnell case out of California, where the hospital had agreed with a provider to provide coverage and accept this payment in full. I don't think that's a valid distinction from this situation, because in those cases, the agreement or allowing the hospital to collect more than the agreement really didn't affect anybody except the hospital and the patient.
You began by saying there were 3 points.
Well, the first point,
the lower court, you covered one. Have we gotten to the other two yet?
Well, the first point, and we've jumped around a lot, so I'm not sure how much of each we've covered, but the first point is that there was no debt, and without a debt, there's no valid link. Secondly, when you read the language of the labor code, under the canons of construction and the ideas of construction laid out by this court in the Crown Life versus Castile case, taking into consideration the language of the hospital lien statute and the objectives and intent behind that statute, which, as the Bashara case from this court and the Borders and Herman Hospital case all said, that the purpose of the Hospital Lien Act is to give hospitals protection for non-paying patients. These gentlemen, by being covered by comp, were guaranteed paying patients if the hospital had a problem with the bill, they had an avenue to address that. Additionally, I think this case is more important than the ones where the hospitals agreed by contract, because in this case, allowing the hospital to collect more than what was provided by workers' comp, and which by statute is supposed to be a fair and reasonable rate, affects the patient, affects the hospital, and affects the workers' comp system and frustrates their goals of controlling medical costs and bringing employers within the comp system, because every dollar that goes to the hospital reduces the future credit. Every reduction in the future credit has to be accounted for in the workers' comp carriers' budgets, and by increasing their budgets, those increases get passed along as premium increases to employers. Then that affects.
Mr. Gillen, two things.
Yes, sir.
What would be your position in regard to the stabilization, the time that the hospital has to treat the patient up to stabilization? Should the hospital be able to recover that?
I think that the hospital should be able to recover that, but in this case, because of the all-encompassing nature of the workers' comp system to allow it to operate effectively, the hospital should only be able to recover that through the workers' comp system.
All right, so what is your answer then? Is the hospital limited under your scenario to the workers' comp allowance even for the time up until stabilization?
Yes, Your Honor.
And they don't have any right to go into their hospital lien to recover their full cost up for that short period of time, even.
I don't believe that they should.
Okay, well then then what's the difference? Then you're saying if they continue to treat after that, they've agreed under the statute, they've agreed. But up to that point, they have not agreed.
So they have not agreed. You're correct, Your Honor, but I don't think that the agreement should be the basis for the decision on whether or not they're limited to what workers' comp.
Okay, so then we take the agreement of the statute out. You're now abandoning your position that they've agreed by treating this patient?
Well, now, I'm not abandoning that position.
Okay, well, then they haven't agreed at the front end. They have to take him.
They have to take him to the point of stabilization.
Okay,
correct.
They haven't
presented any evidence, Your Honor, for this court.
Okay, now, not on this record. Not on this record. I agree. There may not be evidence on this record. But if there were evidence dividing that out,
if there were evidence dividing,
complete your
if there were evidence dividing that out, I guess it gets beyond the facts of this case, and I really haven't given an extensive amount of time and effort to that question. But I think to allow the workers' comp system to operate as the way the legislature intended it to, and in accordance with the provisions of the statute and regulations, if it's a workers' comp patient, I think they have to abide by the workers' comp statute. If it had been a Blue Cross patient or somebody where they didn't like the HMO contract, then they might be able to enforce their lien and ignore billing under that contract.
Chief, can I ask one short more question?
Yes, Mr. Johnson.
In regard to the mechanics of how the carrier gets credit for future medical, and I think we kind of hit the mist on that, is there any provision under the administrative code limiting the carrier $175,000, and let's presume that the evidence is this was all past medical that we're talking about here. There's no testimony that probable future medical, no evidence of probable future medical at the time they settled, and then 3 years later we come up with a bad back or something that's traceable to the injury. Now, is there any provision either way about whether the carrier can offset that entire $175,000 if the person needs it, but none of it was allocated to future medical in the settlement?
The statute, if I follow you correctly, sections 417.001 and 002, especially 002, say that the net benefit or net amount received by the injured patient is a credit against future benefits. And future benefits can include medical or wage benefits. So I don't think that the statute does not make a distinction between whether it's credit for medical or credit for pain and suffering or credit for other things. Just the entire amount would be attributed for it as a future credit.
So the 175, if that's eaten up in future medical, even though it's not anticipated or allocated, that can all be offset against the future medical.
That's correct.
As you understand it.
That's correct.
Thank
and
you.
If they go beyond the 175, then the comp carrier has to start paying again.
Thank you.
Any further questions? Thank you, Governor.
I'd like to address the argument that since there's no debt, there can be no lien that applies, which is the primary argument that respondents have made. If you look at Section 413.042, let me back up. Council cited to the Texas Administrative Code and said that pursuant to its participation in the workers' comp system, the hospital, Providence Hospital, agreed to abide by the provisions of the Workers' Comp Act. The only provision of the Workers' Comp Act that deals with this is 413.042. It does not say that the debt is extinguished. What it does say is that the hospital cannot collect from the employee. When the legislature did that, in 1989, codified it in 1993, the McCollum case was already on the books. And the McCollum case up in Dallas said very clearly, and it was repeated in Bar Journal articles and otherwise, that regardless of regardless of the effect of the workers' compact, whether or not there was a comp claim or not, which was an issue in that case, the hospital lien statute had to be satisfied.
So if you tried the case and the plaintiffs, rather than asking for the complete doctor bills, just asked the $20,000, just asked for the $10,000, just the $10,000 that, in fact, was paid out of pocket.
The jury
awards them $10,000. Your position is the hospital still gets $20,000.
That's correct. But in the real world, that doesn't happen because the plaintiffs always ask for, you know, as much or way more than they could reasonably get. That's in the real world.
But the hospitals don't do that.
I'm sorry?
The hospitals don't do that when they bill.
My point is your argument doesn't turn on windfall, because whether the plaintiffs get a windfall or shortfall, the hospital, your rule is, number one, the hospital gets paid.
If it is out of third party funds, my belief is that this court ought to harmonize the statutes, and that the Hospital Lien Act ought to take hold. And if there are third party funds to be applied,
even if a jury says the reasonable bill for this hospital is $10,000, the hospital gets $20,000 anyway.
You know what? And I honestly don't know the answer to that question, because the Hospital Lien Act only allows reasonable and necessary charges. So if the hospital charges are $30,000 and the jury says the reasonable and necessary charges were $10,000, I'm not sure what the result would be, to tell you the truth.
So reasonable and necessary are different from fair and reasonable. I mean, that's what I'm struggling with, is the Comp Act presumes that those amounts are fair and reasonable. And if the Lien Act only allows what's reasonable and necessary, why are they not the same? Why is what's fair and reasonable more if you get it from a third-party tortfeasor as opposed to if you get it from Comcast?
I can tell you that in court, the standard is going to be reasonable and necessary. I can tell you that in court, the plaintiff is going to ask for all of the medical that's been incurred, whether that's limited to and not be limited by what the comp carriers pay. And I can tell you that the comp carriers' rates, the reimbursement rates, in some instances, to hospitals have not increased since 1997, and I can assure you that when they were first subjected to the rulemaking in 1997, it wasn't a windfall for the hospitals then, and they have risen substantially since then. So I can't agree that as we stand here today, that the government's view of or that the you know the reimbursement rates from 1997 are fair and reasonable compensation.
Well, I understand, but there's an avenue to contest that.
There is an avenue to contest that.
And it would require us to find, as a matter of law, that the Workers' Comp Act rates are not fair and reasonable. We have to presume that.
For participation in the comp setting, I don't believe, and for the rates that are to be reimbursed by the comp carrier, I do not believe that this court has to find.
Complete your thought.
I do not believe that this court has to find that the comp rates are not fair and reasonable in order to also allow the operation of the Hospital Lien Act.
Any further questions? Thank you, counsel. That concludes the argument, and the court will now take a brief recess.